Welcome to The Revolution Will Be Humanized, The Glass Age Approaches. We are streaming this live on May 27th. We are gathered here because Alexander Hayes contacted me and said, "Hey Jeff, would you be interested in streaming a conversation about some stuff?" And I said, "Yeah, that sounds interesting." And so we have a bunch of people gathered here, possibly some more coming in, to talk about what stuff, Alexander?
Well, what we did do is we did talk about, I posed a series of questions, and I hope that perhaps we could just sort of move through those one by one and see where things are heading, because they start off really talking more broadly about technology and then narrow down into a specific type of technological, it's not an invention, it's been around for 25 years or so. But really the onset of that particular type of wearable technology. So the first question that I posed was, before we do.
I'm wondering if we can kind of set the table a little bit and provide some overview.
Okay.
Because I think people who live in the world that you live in assume certain things that others might not be aware of. And what this stuff is kind of wearable technology. Google Glass has been released and is gaining some traction. There's a big conference in Toronto. I'm wondering if you can take just a couple minutes and tell us about the technology that we're talking about, where it's at now and where it's likely to head.
Okay. For the last 25 years or so, there's been a number of lead innovators who have looked at technologies which can enhance, can capture, and can interact with our immediate environment. Those particular technologies are specific to your eyes and ever increasingly to your brain. So,
and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but right on cue, Steve Mann has joined us, and I want to say welcome and thank you very much, Steve, for joining us.
Hello, and thank you for having me here. I can only be on briefly because I have a meeting with the chair at 10:30 EDT.
And because of that, Alexander, if you don't mind, I'm going to give Steve the job of answering that question, which was I'm asking him to kind of set the table a little bit about this discussion, because I know some of you live in this world of wearable technology, and Steve, you've been living there for a long time and wearing things on your face for a long time. I'm wondering if you can give us your take on where we are in the curve of wearable technology, what we're talking about when we're talking about these kinds of things.
Okay, I guess there's two things. One thing is, I presume you've probably read the interaction design article on wearable computing that summarizes a lot of these issues.
I can provide that. Steve, your camera's pointing at your workshop. Ah, that's better. we could see your hair, but nothing more.
Yeah, I'm actually not wearing my mic, so I'm just sort of leaning over to speak into the mic here.
Okay.
But the I should put my iTap camera on the feed too. But the
please do.
The thing that I think is important is the main issue is sort of augmented reality. You know, the idea as soon as you're wearing a camera. You see, augmented reality has three things. It has a wearable camera, I call it a wear cam. It has a wearable computer, I call it a wear comp. And it has a wearable display, I call it a wear disp. And that creates something that we call augmented reality, which is a sort of smart AR or intelligent AR that is sensitive to its surroundings or environment. It's not just a wearable display, like a private eye type reflection technologies display over one eye. Isn't really AR, although a lot of people call it that. So I prefer to sort of make the distinction of augmented reality as a sort of intermediary where the computer serves as an intermediary. One of the things that necessarily raises is the issue of valence, because you're wearing a camera. And this is kind of what I found over the last 35 years of wearing glass, that a lot of people were freaked out by it. I mean, in my childhood, I kind of invented this as a computerized welding glass. In welding, we look through a dark glass to see everything. Not usually glass, it's just one piece of glass. And we look through the dark glass, and it helps us see by simply diminishing the reality around us. And I realized that what we need to be able to do is to augment or diminish, in other words, augmediate the reality as an intermediary, not just augment and add new things to clutter our lives, but to actually fulfill the main vision of glass. When we were using glass in the weld shop, you know, the purpose there was to help people see better. I learned to weld when I was about 4 years old. My grandfather taught me, and so I understood the idea of seeing better by looking through glass. But the thing is, what I wanted was glass that would augment the darker areas of the image and diminish the brighter areas of the image, and overlay also computer graphics and text and things like that. So then that necessarily is glass that has to have a camera and a display and a processor. And so as a result, this brings us valence. I mean, surveillance is watching from above, where you have a camera that watches over people the way that police watch a suspect. But the conference that we're having with the IEEE, the IEEE ISTAS, is on the theme of augmented reality and wearable computing in everyday life, which is necessarily not surveillance, but just valence. Valence mm-hmm. means watching, and surveillance means watching from above. And I think that the theme that we have to really talk about, the thing that everybody's freaking out about over the last 35 years when I started wearing this glass, is the camera that's in it and how that impacts on life. And at first I was just building this to help myself and others see better. But then I realized, after being, you know, physically assaulted simply for wearing a camera to try to see better, a lot of people said, lawyers and everything said, oh, you better keep a record of everything that's on that camera so that you can use it in court against the perpetrator.
Mm.
Which I saw you did. I was reading your post on the incident at McDonald's in France. Since our time is limited, I hope you don't mind if I jump ahead to sort of core questions. You mentioned the ISTAS 13 conference, which is coming up next month in Toronto, and these issues are going to be prominent, the issues of privacy and how to deal with all this valence in our world. What's the debate going to be? So, yes, there are concerns about privacy, and how are things going to line up? Is it going to be corporations against open content people? What are the sides of the argument going to be?
Actually, it's not really a clear 20th century us versus them argument. It is not surveillance by the police against citizens doing surveillance. You see, people often misunderstood surveillance and surveillance with a 20th century us versus them to say that surveillance is inverse surveillance, and surveillance is the police watching citizens and the shopkeeper watching shoppers, and surveillance is the citizens watching the police and shoppers watching shopkeepers. But rather, I think that the more modern definition of surveillance is the capture and sensing or recording or processing of activity by a participant in the activity, as sensed by a participant in the activity. So the issues, I think the key fundamental issues are, one is principles like the sensory entitlement principle. Actually, if you look at the valence paper, wearecam.org/valence/valence.pdf, that's a paper that we've entitled Valence Part 1. That lays out all of these issues. And the issues are mainly a matter, things like sensory entitlement. Does somebody else have entitlement over one's own senses? If one's wearing a glass to help see better and somebody demands that you take it off, then maybe that person becomes liable if you trip and fall because you just took off the glass and suddenly changed how you're understanding and seeing the world. The other issues are, I mean, there's the issues of valence, and there's also the issues of ITAP criteria. Does it meet the ITAP criteria? Is it going to actually help people see better, or is it just going to confuse people and cause them to bump into walls and things like that? And those criteria, like the camera has to be the eye, the camera can't be offset from the eye. If the camera is away from the eye, immediately you've gone down to generation one glass, which causes all kinds of problems. The camera has to be the eye itself.
And I'm wondering if you don't mind another tech question, because you've been experimenting with this stuff for quite a long time, and it seems like you've had a lot of features years ago that is not available yet. Things like face recognition and the spectral options. What's your take on this first version of Google Glass, and how quickly do you think this is going to develop? How would you like to see it develop?
Well, this first is what we call a Generation 1 glass. And this is what we did back in the 70s, is to have a camera hooked to a wearable computer, wearable camera, wearable display, and see through the camera. But the camera wasn't the eye itself. And this caused a lot of problems. I tried it down below where you look down to see it. I tried it up above where you look up to see it. And I tried it straight ahead where you look straight ahead to see it. And wherever you put it is kind of irrelevant. But the main central issue is that you've got this eye that's outside your eye socket, and so it's disorienting. You get this effect where neural pathways are developed in the brain to overcompensate for this strange mapping. And so what I did to break that cycle and cause and to stop it from giving me a massive headache was I just flipped the image upside down so that it forced me to adapt to a very, very different mapping rather than one that was close to the identity. Because whenever the mapping was close to the identity, I was banging into walls, and it kind of started to screw up my mind a little bit. So I found if I rotated the image 90 degrees or turned it upside down, it left, right, it made all that go away because it was so disorienting as to not confuse it with reality. And then after a little while, I adapted to it. So that was the first thing I discovered. But then the second thing I discovered, make a new generation called 2 digital eyeglass. We used to call this digital eyeglass, kind of like a welding glass, but digital, computational. And the generation 2 glass caused the eye itself to become both the camera and the display. And so that was the next step. And then the problem with that is that one eye was focused differently than the other, because the tapped eye, if you have a single eye tap, was focused maybe at one depth, and the untapped eye was focused at a different depth. So then the next thing was generation 3 glass, which tracks the focus, and then finally generation 4 glass, which has infinite depths of focus, what we call laser eye tap.
I know our time with you is running out, and I want to give other people a chance for a question. I have to ask the question. I've seen this on your blog posts, but why is Steve Mann... are you involved in Google Glass at all? If not, it seems odd that you're not. Why would that be?
It's an interesting question. Maybe we can get some discussion on that. It's a deep question. I mean, a lot of my students are working there, and a lot of my students have been approached, and some of them are working there, and some of them have stayed. We started a number of other companies and so on along the way. And so, like, we have Interaxon, which is uses our brainwave technology to. So we have this product called the Muse, which reads brainwaves, and so some of my students are running that, and some of those students have, and various other students have been approached by Google. So there's a lot going on here, and there's probably a lot of unanswered questions. Life is stranger than fiction, I guess, and. I have to go in about 30 seconds, so I don't know if there's any, maybe we'll meet up at ISTAS, and I hope that all of you will be able to come to ISTAS, and we have Ray Kurzweil and Marvin Minsky and myself giving this opening keynote, and then we have a bunch of other speakers. We've got Gordon Bell from Microsoft and a bunch of other speakers. Some really good speakers will be coming, and we're going to touch on really drill right down into actually these core issues.
And for those of us who are not going, we hope we're going to be able to either tune in live or catch the recordings in some kind of open content way, but we're not sure we are.
Well, there'll be a lot of us with iTap, Generation 4 glass, so that might help at least give some vestiges. But, you know, the power of being there and actually meeting face-to-face all these wonderful people, I think it should not be overlooked.
Of course not, but so nice to have a stream, a little bit of valence on the conference itself brought out to us. So we'd appreciate it.
Yes,
you can lobby for it. Do so.
So anyway, I've got to run now, but I might join back on if there's I don't know how long this will run for, but I'll check in and at least be online in some way or another.
All right, great. Thanks, Thank you very much, Steve.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, Steve.
And I want to say hello to Maria, who has joined us. Hello, Maria.
Hi, Maria.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Delighted you could join us. Alex, before we get back to the questions, is there anything you wanted to follow up on what Steve had said?
Just one. I've added a number of chat posts into the chat area. The very last link I put in there a moment ago is quite pertinent, I think, to think of this in context of the actual event itself, which is, can you imagine going to a conference where the lanyard itself is in actual fact a camera which is pointing and recording at every other person? So I've put the link in there, and you can see that Nelly, the speakers, were in the Toronto conference. That's correct. I'll put the chats back there. Maybe Cam, well, that surveillance camera is pointing at every single other delegate that's in that environment. And what that might mean for the behaviors of the people that are in that particular environment itself. So when you say that you'd like to see some data that's coming from that that event, we will, most definitely. It'll be spread liberally across the web. Whether it's live or not, it's a different matter. I'd like to see that there were some live points in there that people could hook in. And I think this is a classic example that we can use Google Hangout this way and stream it out. And that's been the focus of the organizing committee, is to try and push that forward.
Can you tell us a little bit more about why this conference? I get a sense this is a really important conference, not just by its nature and who gets invited, but somehow the timing of it, that something special is going to happen, or have I misperceived that?
No, I think you're quite correct. Within the next 6 to 12 months, there will be a large release of a number of different devices or technologies that will be seen and will be seen to be changing the way that we interpret the internet to be. The examples are the Momoto camera. So if you go to Momoto.com, go to Autographer, worn essentially around the chest or breastbone, either clipped to your clothing or worn like a pendant on your neck. They're fairly innocuous looking devices. They're fairly featureless, but essentially they're a camera and sensor based device that takes any number of different types of sensing from reacting to light, to pedometers, to monitoring your heart, to monitoring your step, pace, camber, gait, all of these different data sets, as well as taking a photo every 4 or 5 seconds. So if you can imagine at the end of the day, having access to photos that have been taken every 4 to 5 seconds from your chest bone, from this sort of position here forward, as well as Google Glass, which is an augmented overlay, as well as the ability to take photos and video, they are definitely going to have a difference in the way that we interpret data. So the data that will come forward from those activities will start to become quite permeated across the internet. And you're starting to see some now with applications like Vine.co and a series of other short burst videos that can be bite-sized tweets spread liberally and quickly across environments. So the way that people will behave will be different.
While we're talking about the gear, Steve kind of touched on the design aspect. You know, he was saying when you have the view angle off your main normal vision, it can be very disorienting and cause eye strain. And some of the designs I saw were more like, they just looked like Terminator sunglasses, which seems to me that if the interface was right in front of your eye, it would be a little bit, not only might you avoid that eye strain, but you might socially seem a little bit less strange. It would just look like you're wearing glasses.
Indeed. The idea, as you mentioned, also might have noted that Steve was using the term org mediated. He wasn't using the term augmented. So when we drill down on what he means by org mediated, essentially it's the ability to see through and interact with real life lifetime objects. It's a filter that can also preclude ads, or can intervene with certain surfaces that you're interacting with. So if you can imagine, and I saw it really well demonstrated at the AR camp recently here at Canberra University in Australia. If you think about it, currently we have a QR code, but we have to, with our hands, essentially grab a technology of some description and place it over the QR code or in the field of view of the QR code in order for our device to interact with that particular QR code, which, by the way, are very butt ugly. So if you can imagine that if you're not having to hold something in your hand, it's become a wearable technology and it's within your visual field of view, you'll be interacting with all sorts of different fields, and your world, the layers of the things that you see in an everyday context, will markedly differ. So yet that of having to pull the thing out of your pocket, or hold the iPad up in the air. Or...
Yet at the same time, as I was watching these interface videos, I found myself thinking, I kind of want a hand control, because you watch these Google Glass videos, and you know, okay, wearing a strange device is one thing, but walking around saying, "Okay, Google, take a picture." Okay, good, is even stranger. Whereas if, like, I can imagine like a little ring joystick or something where you could control the device.
Well, I mean, you think about the way you drive a car, right? One foot uses a brake, you know, one foot on the gas, and you've got a hand on a stick shift. And if you had to give vocal commands to all of those different machines, it would be a bit more challenging. I mean, we do have other body parts that are helpful. I'd like to go back just on a couple of points there. One of them is about how the social weirdness of the process. I don't think that we've had a better example of social weirdness than people adapting to their phone technologies and the sort of change in eye direction and all that stuff. So I don't think that's a particularly big challenge. I think that as long as people are being honest about the fact that they're wearing wearable devices and they're entering into the social contract with that kind of honesty, I don't think that's going to be any different than people making sidelong glances at the phone under the table. Go ahead.
On that one point, if I may, Steve's very, very keen to point out that these cameras that are worn, like the Autographer and the Momoto camera, are worn as an honesty pendant. So if you think of the terminology of honesty pendant, what it is doing is an extension of the way that you're surveilling the environment or surveilling the environment for your own purpose, not for the purpose of a consortium or a government.
Right.
But the question the other point, that arose, yeah, from there.
The other point that I wanted to raise is, I was imagining, let's say, 500 people at this conference, all with wearable devices recording things. Having been involved in really massive amounts of sort of events with lots and lots and lots of people doing stuff, getting recordings of things is never a problem. Curation is always the problem. Mm-hmm. So if you have... If you look at a conference now, there's, you know, 500 times more things recorded than there would have been 15 years ago, because everybody's carrying a recording device in their pocket. Mm-hmm. But they only pull it out at certain times, and only certain people do it. If we imagine everybody doing that at the same time, how are we possibly going to curate any of this?
So that it's useful. If you can imagine a visual timeline, where if I could say to you at 11:20 yesterday, I lost my keys somewhere or other. So it was around about 11:20. So I can zoom back visually from my perspective as to what I was doing at that particular point. So zooming back across that body of content digitally is very, very fast, very rapid, easy to do.
But that's for me. I mean, when you've got 500 people doing it. Personally, I can totally understand how that'd be helpful. I lose my keys 5 times a day. But I mean, when you've got, it's the scale part of this, because it's always the scale that kills every one of these projects. So
yeah, it is. It is. And the scale was, I'll put into the chat there, about SenseCam, the Microsoft project, which has run for a long time, where they decided to cut audio off because of the cultural permissions around privacy and security that were revealed when audio was connected with visual environment. But they are, from what I understand, that scalability in the nature of drillability and rediscoverability and reusability of content is being mastered quite quickly. So the algorithms and the ability to drill visual images and also geolocation, particularly geolocation of when, where something happened. Let me pose a scenario quickly. Imagine if, for instance, the Boston bombings occurred, they were able to tap into everybody's perspective at that particular point in time, or even maybe 300 people's perspectives of the geolocated camera-based data that was wearable at that particular perspective. Not just what was handheld, but not what was in video format, but from where people were currently engaging with from their body. The situation would be, again, closer and probably even more accurate and quicker. So that's in a surveillance mode. But in a surveillance mode or in a pointing back, perhaps that would be very useful for our own memory, and perhaps it'll be very useful for any number of different reasons, and that's the point of this particular conversation tonight, to explore what those apprehensions might be, those usefulness, those perspectives or social engagement spaces.
All right, I think we've laid the table. I think we've talked tech, we've talked terminology. Let's get to kind of the benefits and concerns, and let's start with the benefits. You've suggested a couple. What else is the bright side of this coin?
Well, as I have been involved in this space for since 2003-04, and that's, you know, I'm a newcomer in the context of the MIT Cyborg Lab, the Perceptual Computing Group, HCI, across the world in general. Benefits I can see in just about every single trade area that there is, in that people by their own choice can quickly record actions from the perspective of the point of view of the wearer and can easily transmit that data set across to another learner in, who is trying to master a certain type of task or other. The way that we currently do that is that we need to be there physically to demonstrate how something is achieved. We then have to reverse in our own mind, as Steve was saying earlier, his whole reversal of image is part of the way he remains, you know, marginally sane. It's about how you can capture, record, transmit, digest and re-emulate something in a way that I think is useful, that I'm interested in an educational context. And that is both augmented or mediated and also just straight data capture, audio, video from the perspective, from the first person perspective. So for me, the benefits are firstly to think about, if I take something from the first person perspective, what does it do for my own thinking? What does it do for the person who I'm trying to transmit or to convince that this is the correct way to do something? And how relevant is that within the context of that particular person's life?
Anybody else want to chime in with the reasons to be excited?
Well, I have a perspective. Hi, my name's Rob.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Rob.
You mentioned a few things along the way there, the benefits, you know. I saw a university campus guy driving by with a Segway the other day, and I took my iPad and I started to hang out.
Yeah.
I do humorous things. So this is my... this is my harmonica holder, so I've created a Bob Dylan, and then I would attach this to it. So if this kind of deals with that issue of, are you, so this is a media device.
Yes.
So I think that people will have different types of wearable items, you know, Somebody said they worked with earlier said they worked with visors for welding helmets, and this is a you know, just attaching different types of wearable devices for different reasons. Mm-hmm. All of mine happen to be less than $5, that's all. Mm-hmm. And that's why I find it kind of humorous using, you know, just existing devices.
Mm-hmm. Kudos for coming prepared with props.
Benefits for marketing, education. I can do my consulting from in the world. Mm-hmm. Instead of doing it as we're doing right now, you can see what I see. When I teach people languages, international languages, they go to the Walmart with me. They go to the farmer's market with me. They experience with me, don't look at me, look at what I see.
Mm-hmm. So. That's a good point. And that's the first way that I came in contact with this. I was in a very remote part of Australia. I met a person who was wearing a video camera on their head and a small DVR recorder on their hip. They happened to be underneath a car in a very confined space recording aspects of a particular mechanical type of behavior. And then after they had finished their task, they would then cut the video into short segments and transmit that by Bluetooth to their students. That allowed the students to get into that remote location. What have you got there, Bob?
This is a 99 cent Swiffer with a piece of Velcro on it, which I attach a cell phone to.
Yep.
And then I push it underneath my vehicle and say, how do I fix this? And then I raise it up in the air and I say, hello, Angelina, how's the red carpet walk going?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, I these are just silly little things, you know, but just how might things be used?
But I like the price range.
So yeah. Do I.
Yeah, 99 cents and a piece of Velcro.
You're so playful. It's great.
I like it.
All right, so they're wonderful, lots of great stuff. Let's get to some of the concerns, starting with some that have been mentioned in the chat room. Nelly was asking, so how much was the military involved in the development of this technology?
Well, ostensibly always, but before military, there's always pornography. So, and that's serious. The pornography industry switched its field of view and its marketing context to first-person perspective a long time ago. And in doing so, it opened up a new market, but it also opened up a different type of behavioral shift in humanity that perhaps has been very much to the detriment of the subject. And Professor Steve Mann is very quick to point out that some of the concerns that are being raised are around the rights of the subject, the rights of the person who is within the field of view of these particular consortium connected devices. And just having come back from a visiting researcher role in Finland, I experienced much the same thing within a different cultural context. And when I posed various scenarios around how these devices might be used in an affirmative public or otherwise context, I was greeted with some fairly hostile feedback.
Along the lines military, don't ever wear those in this country?
That was one of them. That's correct. You're not welcome in my country if you do wear a similar device, or that the subject in this case is everyone. So therefore, how do you ask permission to on a running level to be able to record audio, video, and transmit that live into another geographical jurisdiction, particularly when those particular connections and streams are intercepted for military intelligence? So what if, military question is very pertinent.
If we were talking about cell phones, you know, with cameras on them, these also, you know, face similar issues And I think, don't you think they're going to be just, say 10 years from now, this will be a passé conversation, do you think?
I think so, and I've just written a paper about that and released it for the STS 13, where I instead of, from a researcher perspective, if you put the data in the center of the circle, and think of the data as the output rather than putting the paper as the output, the publication, the same thing is going to happen with our cell phones and these particular wearable cameras and devices that are actually multi-sensor devices. The Google Glass device is actually connected to your jawbone and audio environment. In terms of the service of glass, there's really only meant to be one wearer, and that if the devices then move to another wearer, that they can demobilize that unit under their terms of service. So essentially you're leasing the device, you're not purchasing it. So if you think of our mobile phone, we still have some autonomy as to what we can do with that device. Yes, the service provider can turn it off, but I can hand my phone, as we do in various cultures, and that phone becomes part of the community, and various people use the phones at various times. So perhaps that right, that fundamental right, will shift. And most importantly, I think, is that this concept of the clunky whole handheld for things to be interacted with is going to disappear very fast. And yes, Vance, I agree with you. I think this conversation will probably be redundant within 2 or 5 years' time.
I don't know, maybe the question about that particular hardware, but I think the issues have been around a while. I don't see the privacy issues disappearing. And it's balancing the rights of the wearer versus the rights of the viewed, I guess, among other things.
If I could perhaps give a use case, when I go to the farmer's market and I have my Bob Dylan on with my cell phone attached, and I'm hanging out with people, with 10 people, then I ask the person, do you mind if I put you live on YouTube? So it's a behavioral thing, not a technology thing. You know, it's very blatant to have something like this pointing at you, but of course you have the field of view and all those things. So just be different.
Well, it looks like it's a question of power, because shops install cameras on by the ceiling and don't ask anybody. Schools install security cameras monitoring students 24/7 or however much time they are there. Increasingly, just cities install outdoor cameras and record everything that's happening at major intersections. But this is now individual people doing it, and somehow it's different. That's a question of who can do it to what groups of people, what individual people.
Speaking of which, Dave, I'm wondering if you can share Bonnie's take on this. Dave, you're muted. Still muted.
Dave? Not live yet.
Dave?
Sorry, I was coughing, so I had both of my mutes on. So I unmuted the first one and started talking, and didn't help at all. So we were talking this morning. Bonnie Stewart is my partner. She's a PhD student at the University of Prince Edward Island, writes on all kinds of stuff in all kinds of places. And she heard I was coming in here this morning and said, yeah, that's another thing. One of the interesting parts about this is how it addresses the idea of gaze in culture, right? So there are some people who are allowed to look at other people and some people who aren't. So you're allowed to look at different kinds of people in a culture. So for instance, I am totally allowed to look at a 4-year-old who's playing in a park. I am not allowed to look at a 15-year-old who's playing in a park. Those are just things about North American culture. One of them is a perfectly normal activity for a North American male to smile at a 4-year-old girl who's playing in the park. Doing the same thing to a 15-year-old is totally inappropriate. But what it does is it forces us to take more honest ownership over those kinds of gaze. So in different parts of the world, different parts of the culture, so different people in different classes are allowed to look at people in different ways. So in North American culture, we have a hidden class structure. We're not allowed to talk about it. It's not socially acceptable to discuss it. It still totally exists. But in other cultures where class is much more overt, you'll end up with people from a certain social class who would never stare at somebody from, say, a higher social class walking down the street, where the inverted is totally appropriate. You can look at a workman who's hammering, who's working on a building for a half an hour, totally appropriate. Looking in the window at somebody who's working at their office desk would probably get you arrested. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's those, the dominance of particularly the male white gaze in our culture becomes a really important discussion when we talk about this kind of constant looking at people for whatever possible reason.
Well, you know, cultural awareness, you know, that's just needs to be improved anyway. It could be, for instance, when I hang out with Islamic women, you don't see their face. They hide, and I didn't realize that at first, or surveillance, you know, different things. So I live in Southern California. There's a lot of people from Mexico, and I have to break them free of that cultural thing, like they won't look at me because that's disrespectful. But those are cultural things, not technology things, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I think technology intermediates and also interrupts and creates chaos amongst that. And so what I've experienced just in the last 6 months has been even a minute level of marginalization by even introducing the topics of this particular always on recording mechanism from the perspective of the wearer. Somebody was mentioning there earlier about, you know, the nature of cameras are now in everything. The idea that I'm very interested in as well is that, and I've had to deal with my own university about this, in the university setting itself, we're quite used to, or the lecturers have become accustomed to being recorded by a surveillance camera that records the lecture that people can access later for later reuse, or at the time, streaming. But now the cameras are actually also pointing at the audience and the learners. And the learners can only interact with the lecturer or the educator by pressing a small black button on the table that's opposite them, so that they can be heard audibly on the stream, and that's been enforced on an equity level. So what I'm interested in is what becomes of that setting when learners enter that environment wearing a camera that is also audio recording, and when they assert the rights that they're recording for their own personal safety. If they state, I'm here, I'm wearing this device, don't preclude me from this environment because I'm wearing this device for my own personal safety, not for entertainment, not for a lifeline capture, not for socialization, but simply for my own safety. What do we say back?
Maybe related to that, I use a Hangout in the classroom, mm-hmm. just for fun. People are giving permission, they see themselves, they see their own actions, but it also gives the students in a very small setting, it gives them the ability to, you know, control the screen and do the other things, you know? And so it's not just so they're more interactive with it. Of course, we just turn the sound off because we can hear each other, and it's a very small classroom, doesn't have 500 people in there.
No. Do any of the students in that setting record you? Are they recording you from
that in our little experiments, right? Then yes, everything is recorded. But only it's like a hangout, permission hangout on the air. It's permission based.
And I suspect you wouldn't mind if they had their own recording device and recorded you. I think the question is who gets to make those rules? The case of, you know, McDonald's can videotape you. Are you allowed to videotape McDonald's?
No, you're not.
Are you allowed to surveil the surveyors? Where are we in terms of legislation? Is any of this legislated? And I imagine it's going to be legislated differently in different places. That's going to be a mess.
It is. This introduces another level of legislation, much like UAVs or unmanned aerial systems are at the moment, between domestic, commercial, and military use. There's a lack of legislation around how they can be used. This is essentially the same. If you have en masse people descending on an environment, recording, transmitting live that environment in a non-obvious way, it's bound to break rules or break current legislation laws around privacy, security, national security, and other. So the conference itself is a gathering at an intersection, at a time, as you mentioned earlier, that is really at the crossroads as to where this is actually going to go. the keynote presenters coming in from singularity from one side through to philosophy and the arts in all sorts of different ways. It's a collision of all of those different perspectives and anxieties of people around what this might mean, not only for their interaction with their loved ones, but also what it might mean in their workforce, what it might mean in the public.
We're coming up to an hour, and we can certainly go over, but I want to make sure we get whatever in that we want to get in, starting with anyone in the Hangout who hasn't had a chance to speak and would like to join in. If anyone has seen something in the chat that they would like to share, please do so. Matthias, we haven't heard from you, or Michael?
Maria? Yeah, well, at the moment I'm giving lectures in physics, and one thing I was just thinking of, I think that many of the users of Google Glass is sort of like small, tiny use cases that you just don't think about at the moment. So for example, I was building my own document camera instead of buying a really expensive one. I use these kind of physics laboratory equipment and an ordinary webcam. So I built my own document camera to be able to sit and film my own handwriting when I was solving some problems, instead of using the projector for that or writing at the blackboard. So for example, a Google Glass could be used, of course, as a document camera instead. So that's just one thing, but I know there are millions of things I think that I've come to think about, but that's just one thing that pops up in my mind. But the security questions and all that, I mean, I live in Sweden, and I guess there could be some different rules here. So I think there will be, I guess that's also one of the points that we get many of the Google services quite late, since there are millions of different kind of rules and regulations. So I don't know even when we will get the possibility to use Glass in the end.
And yet some of Google's largest servers exist in your country.
And I think actually Hangouts is developed in Sweden, so...
It is.
That's great.
And also, since we have a whole bunch of educators here, I'd love to hear any other thoughts about how this might be used in education. We've heard a couple. Anyone else here or in the chat room have thoughts on how we could actually use it for positive educational purposes?
I have one more use case. I take my classroom in new product development into the field with, you know, my little hotspot. I said, why do we have to be in a classroom, period? So let's go out to the park, or let's go, if we're going to do new product development, let's go get into the use field. And we can actually hang out with devices and do those things, as opposed to being confined to a building. So that's
I don't know if you've seen the video with the guys, the physics teacher, I guess, who went to CERN and hang out from within the CERN area, looking at the huge detectors and so on, areas that is most probably restricted to most people. So we can actually bring the students into areas and interact with them, looking at, I don't know, interesting things.
When you said physics, I was thinking of going up to the top of the building and dropping the phone off so that they could do the whole, experience it live.
I'm doing a type of project called Math Track, where people go on scavenger hunts for mathematics. So we used to do it with photo cameras, just taking static pictures and then finding mathematics or writing stories. With this technology, we are planning to do it live with people joining us on the Math Track from their homes and submitting ideas or submitting virtual models of what we find. So different enhanced mathematical experiences that people can bring if they are sitting at powerful computers while someone else is working in the field.
I think I have the...
Learning things, searching for things.
I think one interesting use case would be, Rob, instead of dropping one of these and using the the accelerator and so on in this one. If there's an accelerator in the Google Glass, you should drop yourself from a plane and then plotting live, sort of like the speed and the position graphs for the students in the classroom. So that that could actually have me jumping from an airplane.
It was one of the cases that Google did run with Sergey Brin. Was one of the first cases. I have been. Yeah. I have left a few devices, pivot head glasses with base jumpers, and they're submitting some data back to me, so we can choose, and perhaps share that with you what it is like to base jump. There are lots of point of view perspectives as to you can yourself feel the tension within that base jumper before as they prepare and as they jump, quite an emotive connection when it's from the first person perspective.
And someone else has put a bird's eye view. I think I saw that on a hangout. Right? It was a device attached to a bird, a device attached to a whale.
And these attachable, wearable, or as Steve will call, bearable cameras are very much part of our whole sense of humanity now. We have cameras embedded in just about everything.
And it will be interesting to see how the technology evolves. You know, I was reading the iPhone came out, next month will be 6 years. And it's hard to imagine life without smartphones now. And they've, you know, there's a certain commonality, a certain difference. So it'll be, I hope competitors rise to provide some diversity with Google Glass. I'm also wondering, I'm sure Mac's going to get in eventually. I'm sure others have had this thought, but what would they call their wearable technology? The II?
Eyeglass.
digital eyewear.
Some threads in the chat are taking up things like hacking the situation. I guess that occurred to me when you, Alex, mentioned that only one person at a time can, or this is owned by one person, you know, that person has to wear it, otherwise Google will brick it. But I'm just wondering how long it will take some school kid in Australia to crack that one, you know. I mean, they cracked the national network in about 6 hours. But, I mean, there's a lot of hacking, you know. I mean, these things, I think, are just out of control. And someone mentioned in the text chat that if the cameras, you know, can you block other people's cameras? Can you somehow create interference that would prevent people from filming you? I mean, this seems to be another logical next step. Anybody Shields thought up. About that?
I know how you do that. You take a mailbox and you put it over the device. I did that.
But it would have to be someone else's device.
Yeah.
But in other words, yeah. Well, I think just electronically, can you jam it, for example, to keep yourself being observed? Or just things that people will be thinking about. It's another issue that I haven't really heard mentioned.
Or better still, even that instead of blocking it, we disrupt the signal that they have back by perhaps becoming a QR code. Our wearable clothing and the objects that we carry are triggers which jam their signal. Mm. So augmented reality is very much about what's present visually in a way that changes the interface for the other user. So what sorts of symbols or signs or ciphers or objects can we adorn that will jam this onset?
Wearable technology blockers.
Yeah, jammers.
Wearable jammers.
Yeah. Wearable jammers, that's it. Yeah, that's it. There are a couple of questions that I coined before I got here. One of the ones that stands out to me that we haven't yet answered, and that is around data. So the question was, given the terms and conditions of the providers who govern the use of the device, who actually owns the data? So do we have because the data is a whole range of sets of information, not just simply a photo without other attributes of data, who actually owns it? If it's being captured through a Google Glass device, does Google own that data, or because I'm paying for the use or lease of that particular device, do I own the data? Can they use that unconditionally in a national security context, or can they use it commercially without my permission? How can I assign GFDL to my, or CC BY to the images I take through a Google Glass device?
I'm not clear on the nature of the difference between taking a picture with my smartphone and one with Google Glass.
Neither am I. That's the question.
Because it can have geodata associated with it.
Yes, geodata. Proximity to other users of Google Glass. So if we think of Ingress, I don't know if you've played Ingress, Google Ingress. If I'm near a portal and I'm assigning metadata to a portal, which I notice they don't do, and there's a great deal of educational benefit that could happen there too. Currently, Ingress portals in Google are very, very devoid of metadata. They could be linked into Wikipedia articles around a portal device, generally large cultural objects or important locations or sites. So just picture Google Glass as being an extension of Google Ingress, and the multitude of educational opportunities that there are to assign time and space to a location and describing that from the perspective of the wearer, not just in text, but a live audio, an interaction of different wearers coming to that one environment. That's one thing that comes to mind for me as a positive.
Well, I think the answer to the question is, we would like to own the data, please. I'm curious what Google's license is now. They have the kind of trial sets out. Do you know anything about the licensing there?
Whereabouts in your current G Plus photos can you assign various licensing conditions to your data? And where can you can liberate your data by taking it away, but what happens? It's only a copy of the data. You don't own it. The data is actually still part of the framework of that is composed to provide Google Photos. So there is, I believe, a large data provenance question around, particularly around this particular device type. Not only that, but also devices such as Autographer, which is actually a Microsoft associated long time history product, and also providers like Momoto, which are, I believe, from Sweden as well, Matthias as well. So these people will be questioned intensely about this at this ISTAS 13 event. I'm very interested in the data conversation. Who owns it?
That whole situation on intellectual property rights and all the other things you've brought up with cultural differences, legal differences, and all those types of things. That's intellectual property, and you know they've been dealing with that issue. They never resolved that issue. You know, it's like your opinion. How many opinions are there in the world?
The dominant ones.
Is there a difference between the intellectual rights rules for, say, a Google document and a picture taken and added to Google Plus? I thought they were sort of like making the same rules to rule them all.
Which is, yes. The proximity data will be an interesting one too, because who actually owns the live GIS version of where we cluster and come in contact with each other. So our heat cluster maps of where Google users frequent around events. Who owns the proximity data for that? Is that a commercial product? Can we tap into it and can we hack it and reuse it? Or is that only owned by
corporations? Do governments want to get involved?
Itself? I think they already are. I don't think there's a question of that. It's just how they're involved and to what extent that changes the nature of how we interact with each other as educators particularly, and also what it might mean for our learners as they congregate in spaces, as they capture data, and as they essentially reveal what we don't want revealed quickly and rapidly everywhere. So as the normalization of the wearable technology becomes trendy, fashion, and hip, not just a novelty, what does that do? What does that mean for our...
No, on that topic of location. I like hot food trucks, and they were banned here. So I said, why couldn't I have an opt-in, you know, an opt-in locator of where my customers are? If I owned a food truck, I would know where those clusters are in the field, and whether that's at a Metrolink or public station, as long with a technology like Latitude. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a cluster of my whatever, my students, my customers, my whatever, and that's pretty close with Twitter. But that's Twitter-based. You know, you need to do an input to do that with Latitude, you know, or that technology. I mean, that's been around for a long time, too.
I'd like to bring up one more case that didn't come up, and that's children. Think of the children. Because that has to do with data restriction, too. Because, for example, right now, a 12-year-old legally cannot own a Gmail, let alone do a lot of other things. They do it, they get online, they are just pretending to be not 12 or however old they are. So what about this tech and children? That's very interesting. It's powerful technology, and how will children be empowered with it, or regulated or excluded? That's a big thing on my mind.
To that topic, do you know where your children are? But should your children be able to ask, where is mom at?
Or in fact, to look at their mother and say, is this my mother? So we get to see children wearing Google Glass, but I would imagine with every other technology that we have had, and we've seen young children, very, very young children, using mobile phones and tabletware for a long period of time. So perhaps if it becomes fashionable or normal for adults to be wearing a glass-based device, maybe perhaps even children, it would benefit them to be wearing them too.
Again, cultural, intellectual property, all those things rolled up. Who knows where it's going to end up?
And the point was made earlier in the chat room about how is this going to affect neural development. And certainly if it starts that young, I mean, that can really... You know, I was freaked out a little bit when Steve was saying, and I don't know if that's still the case, but like he's looking at the world upside down in order to make sense of it.
Can I draw your attention exactly to what you're talking about there in terms of the conditions that Google Glass have, and I'll put it in the chat. Google Glass has under its terms and conditions, can everyone use glass? And it says there, glass is not for everyone. Like when you're wearing glasses, some people may feel an eye strain or get a headache. If you've had LASIK surgery, ask your doctor about the risks of eye impact damage before using glass. Don't let children under 13 use glasses, it could harm developing vision. Also, kids might break glass or hurt themselves, and Google's terms of service don't permit those under 13 to register a Google account. If glass is not for you and you wish to return it, do so before the end of the applicable refund period. So the point of children and under 13-year-olds owning the device has already been covered, thought through.
Kind of amazing. The country will let a 5-year-old have a gun, but an 11-year-old can't have Google Glass.
13. Yeah.
They can print a gun.
They can and send it elsewhere. That's right.
Well, they can print glasses.
Hey, what I'm interested is on the road.
Guys, on the road. That's what I like to see. Now turn the camera the other way, not at you. But
let us see what you're seeing.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what we're going to become accustomed to. What I'm very interested to know from people that are gathered here now, if you reflect deeply on your own current life, on your own current way that you interact with technologies in this way, can you yourself picture yourself wearing a camera that produces a life log timeline, like a photo album, every day? Can you picture yourself wearing a camera within the next couple of years, all day long?
No. That's a yes?
I think yes.
That's a yes. Matthias saying yes. Yeah. The reason I ask that is because I have met with Kahul Gurren, who has currently been wearing this Autographer and SenseCam 2 for the last 5 years. He claims in my audio recording of his discussion, which was of a new novelty for him because he doesn't generally get recorded, is that he has not yet experienced any great anxiety or conflict yet of wearing a pendant base camera, which is in his on his chest level just here. He claims that he is a search engine guru. He is not a privacy expert. And I've also met with Gordon Bell, who's the speaker for the keynote dinner banquet speaker at ISTAS 13, who's been wearing the same sort of camera for the last 25 years. So it'd be interesting to see how Matthias's life log will be like in the next couple of years when I tap into it.
You will see me removing 2 billion of these yellow flowers. What are they called? That invade my lawn right now. Like number one, number two, number three. Dandelions? No, I don't know. I don't remember.
Whatever. So that answers that question. But some people haven't answered that one. And I wonder if the answer truly is if it becomes fashionable for other people, or if it becomes part of my workplace expectation. Perhaps if it becomes just normal, I will be wearing a particular camera or device, and that will become part of my life. And I think what we're at this year and into 2014 is the dawn or onset of that type of human behavior.
Well, I mean, I can see wearing it sometime. I just don't want to wear it all the time. I mean, I can see it having some functionality, but some people would wear it all, just like, I mean, how many people, you can do all sorts of life blogging now, but you know, some people document every day. A lot of people just kind of once in a while post something.
Yeah, I'm thinking in terms of Facebook or Twitter, you know, Twitter, for example, has changed. My usage of Twitter, I suppose, and probably most people's, has changed. We used to say things often. Now, I don't know, you just don't feel the urge anymore. And here again, you could hook up your life logger to a Twitter feed or you could automatically post it to, I guess you'd have to have a different service for that, you know, Always On Book or something like that, you know. So the people who are interested in that kind of thing, I mean, there's so many permutations. And I suppose in my own case, I would just feel it was a nuisance and a distraction to what I like to experience life. And, I don't know what I'd do with all the data. I would probably pick times I was going to do it. Like a colleague, for example, has a camera on when he drives in Dubai, and he produces some very interesting, outrageous driving photos. But that's kind of a time when he decides he's going to life log. Might be any of those pictures could be his last, the way they drive in Dubai. But in any event, I'm also aware there's somebody, for example, who was under surveillance by the U.S. government. I'm sure it was that government, and they were bothering him so much that he started life logging and sending the data to the FBI. And just trying to overwhelm him with data. And then I heard about him on the media, perhaps, or one of those podcast programs. And there's another aspect of, you know, just trying to, I don't know, it gets kind of ridiculous, I suppose. I don't know if it's ridiculous or not. We'd have to say, I can't judge Steve Mann, for example, who's been doing it for, you know, half a century, I would think. So, you know, I don't know why he does it. But
I think it would be more interesting to see use cases of communities and groups and tribes doing this purposefully together, and big data interacting in some structured and purposeful manner, assisted by computers probably, and community leaders and curators. Because live streaming, yeah, you get Twitter fatigue or Facebook fatigue from just doing random things. The novelty wears out, but it can be purposeful. It can be serve purposes of collaboration or even collective action.
I believe so, especially when you consider that it can be coupled with a multitude of other data sources, such as if you are not only capturing what you're interacting with, seeing and doing, you're also monitoring your heart rate, hydrostatic pressure, your pedometer, how many steps you're taking, and so on. Perhaps the services that we have in terms of medical intervention or perhaps choice will be differently mediated as to what they have been in the past, where we pay to sit in a room, we pay to talk to somebody who gives us a very conditional-based, non-data-related output based on their own observation. They then have to send us to other environments where they have to scan us to be able to get other information which we could have already given them. So it's a rain. I see it as a data relationship that we could be fostering with services now in a beneficial way, but we have to be very, very careful about what we're volunteering in what way, to what service, and how people could use that for other uses other than beneficial ones, of course. And I've put a link in the chat there. There's a blog, very good blog post there from Autographer that shows how the future of life logging and these multi-sensor based devices and data types are coming together. Gordon's pictured there. He's an elderly man. He wrote a fantastic book called, I don't have the actual title of the book in the back of my mind, Life Bits, My Life Bits, and the project that he talks about is the point where he said, look, the scanner's been invented. Why am I keeping all this paper around? When he just set off on a journey of decoupling his books, scanning the whole lot, and saying, I want to rid myself of all this peripheral, this past life, so I can move into the current life, which is digital media and digital data. So people treat it very differently.
Nellie's comment reminded me of another question I had. She was saying she's looking forward to the day where you wear technology into clothes. On one of the documentaries about Steve, they mentioned, you know, wearable technology and implanted chips. And I wanted to know, is that still science fiction, or is that somewhere on the horizon as well?
Are you talking about Uber chips? Uber violence, as in transdermal in humans, or are you talking about within clothing and so on?
No, I'm talking, my curiosity is transdermal.
It's a current reality. It's not a science fiction whatsoever. There are many different types of prosthetics that people in a medical intervention, from brain computer interfacing with deep brain stimulation for all sorts of reasons, where people are have patented objects which are part of their... I mean, my mother is a walking cyborg. When she sits down and actually thinks for 10 minutes about it, she says, Alex, I have two hips that are fake. I have a heart stent, and I have a range of other implants that make me something different than being a human. And I feel that way. I feel very different because... You know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, this perhaps wouldn't be living this long, and so I'm becoming a different person by that. But there are examples of blood passports coming into Australia for sports people, where they are not only thinking about just GPS bracelets and blood alcohol bracelets for criminals, but also for blood passports, which are a small chip which is inserted under the arm, much like a pill that a lot of females get for fertility. And that blood, that little chip is an RFID environment that gives away data that can monitor the bloodstream and tell whether that particular sports person has been digesting or has had been digesting stimulants or titrates that are banned by various agencies. So it's
And as far as reality. Neural integration, am I going to be able to learn a foreign language by planting it in?
Well, it's interesting that you say that. When you look at the Interaxon product and what that might mean, there's a range of different... I'll just put that into the chat there. It's a very basic examples of Interaxon that allow the second half of glass to come to fruition. So when I think that I want to take a photo, it takes a photo. I don't need to wink or say, glass, take a photo. Essentially, it maps those particular parts of the brain that allow me to command that function. So if you can imagine that being on the back half of your skull and interacting with your brain, then these technologies are just part of an interface with command and, you know, on off simple commands. Whether implanting language and cultures, that's a very different matter. This is what we're doing here.
That's pretty far out. All right, well, why don't we head into the home stretch? Alex, any questions we haven't tackled on that list or anything else you want to address?
Probably just the last question there is one that we need to think about. What are the ethics involved in patenting thoughts as collected via wearable tech? If the genome can be patented, then what about spontaneous thoughts? Then, you know, it's been added in there, but I think that's very important because I think that's it's not that far out. It's not that far away. Thought-based processing and what we control and what we are, we call that to be our private spiritual space. But I think that these devices are becoming closer and they're becoming more like an exoskeleton, that we're part of a corporate exoskeleton. And we have to be careful about what the ethics are behind this. It's a very tricky question. As soon as you put the word ethics in there, people, it's worse than privacy and better. So it's a matter of my personal perspective on these is very different to other people's perspective on these. I would like to think that I could utilize these technologies in a normalized way for an educational positive outcome. I'd like to be able to map what those particular user scenarios would be and to apply those within an educational context. Whether the organization can accommodate that at the moment is entirely clear for me. I'm not able to do so to any great extent. Whenever I talk about data, I talk about the ability to manage life logging as an RPL activity, the ability to create video, personal video portfolios that are user controlled, not corporation controlled or organization controlled, without losing the IP of that data and keeping it private. They're fantastic challenges that'll keep me going for another decade worth of employment, I'm sure. So any other points? I think this is the revolution.
I just want to backtrack. You said the answer for yourself is no. That
it is.
It can. But what was the question again? Can
educational organizations equitably handle the data?
Okay.
And do so in such a way that it makes it easy and makes it manageable for a learner to create a life log that becomes a relationship with the educational organization rather than being subject to courseware, subject to preclusion, subject to sorting. Can the learner enter into a relationship with an educational organization and volunteer data that's being captured in there every day that is collected using these device types?
But they can hire you to help them sort it out.
Hopefully. my contract ends in 3 weeks. I'm happy to.
In my humble opinion, I've always wanted to be, as many of us have, Socrates on a cell phone, or Socrates with a. And so the relationship is between the learner, and if you could imagine Socrates talking with you in a little hangout like this. And it doesn't need an institution.
I like Socrates. I don't like the idea of the Plato side of the conversation.
Yeah, well,
five hats or the others. There's been a range of
and of course we know that we don't know because Socrates didn't really write it down anyway, right? So,
any closing thoughts from anyone?
Nellie's asked a question: how does an artist fit in with this type of technology? Kind of technology. Well, coming from an arts background, I can see a great deal of fantastic interventionist work. Some of the early Howard Rheingold swarm smart mobs and swarm-based activities would be fantastic. But I also, I like to think of the artist as being an interventionist as well as a reflection. So there's a great sort of creative enterprise that could be employed by this data.
And her other question, educational institutions are far behind. Will wearable cameras bring them in faster? My guess would be no. I think it'll cause them to slam the brakes on even harder.
Yeah, and there has been a lot of talk from mobile MOOCs, MOOCs, about where Google Glass and other devices such as iTap fit into that whole mediated reality space, and whether in fact they can, or whether we're still stuck in module-based learning.
I think it might speed the prevalence of alternative, not so much the institutionalized education, but online alternatives or other options.
My hope is this will promote collective learning and group learning in communities and networks, homeschoolers, free schools, higher education, like MOOCs, this sort of thing, where people together form around the data, around smart computer tools, and institutions can keep up or get out, basically.
I'm about 4 weeks into Tina Seelig's Stanford MOOC, and it's interesting, but the most interesting portion of it is that we hang out, that's where the learning occurs in small groups to me, and it really doesn't have too much to do with her system. It's just the hangouts that make the learning for me. And I'm a left brainer, or have been a left brainer, but I aspire to be a right brainer.
Great.
Matthias, Vance, any closing thoughts?
I'm just excited to see what will happen. And in Sweden, I mean, it feels like we're a bit behind when it comes to the integration of technology. So I guess this is still quite a bit ahead of us, but I like being on the edge of looking into the possibilities anyway. So I'm keeping an open mind and two eyes open.
And we'll look forward to picking the dandelions with you.
Yeah. We'll host many times a day, since there are a lot of them.
I think this is a future of learning in a networked world, which is one way I was interacting with Alex and Michael, for example. This is, I sort of see a concatenation of tools, and Maria just mentioned smart tools, smart technologies. If you look at MOOCs, how MOOCs are scaling, education, has scaling what we can do with education. One of the problems that was mentioned earlier was that having all the data requires something that scales in order to curate or in order to make sense of it. So I think those technologies will develop. We're talking about analytics, learning analytics. Well, you can combine this kind of data with some sort of analytics and some sort of system where I could envisage it a lot better than I could sit down and script it. But anyway, that's the kind of thing that I would picture coming together. I sort of see that I would imagine that a lot of the ethical issues that, I mean, well, they'll always be there, obviously, but as these technologies get more and more understood and people are aware of them and take them more and more for granted, and they start cropping up in our televisions that look back at us, we'll sort of accept this. It'll just become integrated with a lot of de-schooling, start catching some of the kids that are being left behind right now, so picking things up. I see a great democratization. I've been disappointed before, though.
Indeed. Jeff, I'd just like to thank you for facilitating the discussion tonight. Primarily because it reaches out across a network of deep thinkers who are connected in a cultural, educational, and other domain. And that's very important to bring. This is actually a resource that will be brought forward into the G+ community for valence, the domain, not surveillance the discipline. And you will see a great deal of data come out of that particular event in Toronto. And if you do happen to be around the Canada Day celebrations, then please come to Toronto and be part of that as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Alex, for asking me to do this. I learned a lot preparing for it, and I learned a lot tonight. I want to thank everyone who participated and everyone who tuned in. Please keep tuned in, because the revolution is coming and it will be humanized. I will say so long for now. Thanks again, and we'll look forward to continuing the conversation next time.